Live from Burbank, California, where trash fees have never been lower. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's a proud drinker of peanut milk. Mark Maron.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Grease Racer, Jim Earle.
Grease Racer.
He's been tagged Grease Racer geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges, and need machines. Welcome aboard. Welcome aboard the giant steam-powered show.
Yeah.
This is the steam-powered Mark Maron Show coming to you from California. We're on tape, and the reason we're on tape is because it takes so damn long for the steam engine to heat up to run the damn show that we can't do it live.
Myth.
Hold on. Let me unleash this. Let a little steam off, because I don't want this thing to explode.
Inaccuracy.
And blow up everybody.
Myth.
Man, we've got some emails around Jim Earle's...
First of all, it's not grease car, they're oil cars. Grease is much different than oil.
I think it's a joke, Jim. Maybe you should lighten it up.
No,
what
I'm going to hunt these bloggers down.
No, lighten it up. Do you understand? I'm telling you, man.
Okay.
Come on, we've got a lot of concern. A lot of people are looking for alternative fuels. They want the cars to run better. They don't want the gas prices to kill them. They want to find a better way, a more efficient fuel to burn that doesn't kill the planet. And we get these emails. We got a blog post from Motown Girl yesterday. Steam cars didn't last because they were not only inefficient, it took a long time to fire up the boiler and wait for enough steam to propel the car.
Baloney.
As with all boilers, they do occasionally blow up.
Baloney.
Okay, and then she says, I'll take biodiesel over steam any day. And she sent us a link to the history of the diesel engine, about how the guy wanted to make the diesel engine originally had plans for peanut oil.
I believe that.
And then he might have been bumped off by the Nazis or the French, who stole his idea and fueled the war effort with diesel engines, but not peanut oil diesel engines. Interesting stuff. It's kind of like one of those Tesla stories. You dig?
Yeah.
Go ahead. What do you got?
Steam engine, okay, first of all, the blowing up the boilers, it's practically never happened. If it ever happened, it was like in somebody's basement.
Yeah.
Most of this country is fueled by steam.
I'm fueled by gas.
We get all our electricity from steam engines, and they've been working for over 200 years now. That's about 100 years longer than a gasoline-powered engine, which is inefficient. Gasoline-powered engine has what? It has 25% efficiency. You know what that means?
Yeah, it's low.
Yeah.
It's not good. That means 75% of it is inefficient, I believe, if my math is correct, Jim.
Steam engines have 40 to 60% efficiency.
Okay.
They have few moving parts. They don't have clutches, transmissions. They don't need all the oil. The gas is a polluting fuel.
I'm all for it. You sold me. All right. And I'm looking forward to the unveiling of the Jim Earle steam engine.
And it takes 60 half hour to, you know, Motown Girl was watching Jay Leno, start up one of his 300 cars. If you don't, if you have 300 cars, you're not going to know how to start up all of them.
The Jimmy Earle Steamer. It's the Jim Earle Steamer. Hey, folks, what a show we got. We're going to continue this.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah, don't you get panicky, because I got an email from a guy that gave me an article on a car that runs on compressed air. I wish I had a valve on my damn head to release some of the... let me just tell you something. Today on the show, Ed Asner, Mr. Grant. We're going to talk to him about television, about comedy.
Mr. Grant.
Yeah, we're going to... Lou. We're going to talk to him about
politics.
I'm
sure he hasn't heard that much.
I'm not going to do that to him. I went through a period where I was completely enamored, not enamored, but in awe of Ed Asner's comedic ability.
Great.
He's one of the great comic actors.
Incredible timing. My mother loved him. My mother loved watching him.
So did my mom. But I just think I'd like to know a little bit about his history. Hopefully he'll share some of that, along with he is part of this group, the 9/11 Truth LA group. He supports that, and I'd like to get his thoughts on the revelation that they have a Pentagon footage of something flying into the Pentagon.
Yeah.
I heard some testimonials today of people actually saw a plane, but that doesn't mean that the speculation around the truth in terms of other elements of 9/11 is not in need of investigation. I am not going to call them conspiracy theorists, because I am really just two or three thoughts away from complete paranoia. I have to manage it. I'm maybe one thought away. Like, you could throw something into my head right now that would make me rethink everything.
You've gotten better, though. I remember when you were like one thought away from paranoia.
Yeah, and I'm surprised, given my vulnerability to that type of strange, unexplainable dogma. I'm not a Christian. Speaking of that, look, Here we go. Michelle Goldberg, author of Kingdom Come, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. A fine book on the subject. I've read other stuff by Mark Crispin Miller. My buddy Christopher Hedges, who has talked to me about it, about the rise of what is really fascism in this country and how we cannot afford to say, hey, it can never happen here. We can't afford to be Jews in pre-war Germany, because whether or not it's going to get that bad, it's certainly going to stifle the democratic or what's left of any sort of semblance of democracy that we have here. And it's a very informed book that gives a very decent and well-researched history of the subject of Christian nationalism. Eric Bates, the national affairs editor of Rolling Stone magazine, will join us for a few minutes today. He's got a deadline, but we're going to talk to him about immigration. Some stuff happened along those lines today. The Senate has okayed a large chunk of fence to be built. But again, I'm going to say this again because I believe it to be true. After all is said and done, after we talked to Mark Cooper yesterday, after all the back and forth, after George Bush makes an address, an appeal to have it both ways, what this is doing is they're going to stifle this legislation. They're going to stall on it until the Republicans can run on either a jingoistic ticket, anti-Mexican ticket, fear-based ticket, or they can run on a proactive immigration policy that enables illegals to become citizens, depending on their constituency. That is what's happening here. I'm not sold on the fact that the Republicans are in disarray. I think they're strategically and effectively preparing for the midterm elections to run on seemingly polar opposites on one issue within whatever district those congresspeople or senators are running in. That's my fear. That sounds like a Rovian scheme to me. Right now, a lot has happened in the news today, so why don't we get into it? We don't want you to be caught uninformed or ill-advised or off guard. So here's the first edition of today's Mark Maron News, short order news. Yes. The U.S. government has released the video showing the hijacked airliner that slammed into the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. But the video is unlikely to quiet those crazy conspiracy theorists out there, because unlike the mainstream media, they insist a video of a plane hitting the Pentagon actually have a plane in it. People were silent as they watched the video at a press conference, except one journalist from The Hollywood Reporter who whispered, "I think Terrence Howard would make a good Musawi." Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has been out of California almost 163 days since his inauguration in November 2003. Nearly one of every 5 days he's been in office. We're all just looking forward to when he's out of office 5 out of 5 days. Cuban President Fidel Castro furiously denied a story in Forbes magazine saying he was worth $900 million and said he would step down if the magazine could prove it. Castro says his net worth is nil and that he earns the equivalent of $40 a month, which is why he's worn the same uniform since 1959. And that's the short order news version one for today, Wednesday. We're up against women's basketball next week. We'll see how that goes. Yeah. I don't know if there's post game or there isn't post game. We got good shows coming up, man. Tomorrow, David Sirota, hero of the fighting Democrats. Tomorrow. He's coming in the studio, right, Charlie? That's awesome. That guy's a sharp guy. You know what I found out yesterday?
No, what?
Yoga makes me angry. I get no peace from it. I sit there, I resent the teacher, I resent holding poses, and by the end of it, I'm raw and aggravated, and it makes me want to yell.
So it's a good thing.
I'm not sure. I don't think that's the effect it's supposed to have. We'll be back with Ed Asner.
And now he's got a child named Zippy. Mark Maron.
It's a good name. Named after a very popular circus entertainer. Nothing wrong with having a kid named Zippy.
No, nothing wrong.
Folks, best known for his work as Mr. Grant on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the spinoff Lou Grant, Ed Asner has appeared in literally hundreds of movies and films, including JFK and Roots. Along with acting, he has joined forces with 9/11 Truth LA. He's now putting a lot of energy into researching and supporting the search for an alternate narrative, or as some would call it, the truth, about the attacks on 9/11. Welcome to the show, Ed Asner.
A delight to be with Zippy's daddy.
Yes, Zippy's dad. I am a tremendous fan. I need to clear something up right off the bat. I was told, I lived in New York for years, and I was told that we lived in the same building. Did you ever live at 200 East 16th Street in New York City? At 16th Street and 3rd Avenue?
Are you kidding me?
No. I'm serious.
Where the heat didn't work.
It worked okay when I was there, but it was like a pre-war building. You know which one I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
When did you live there? When were you in New York?
Let's see. I got married in 59. We lived at 211 East 15th before that.
Uh-huh.
And got married in 59, and we moved into 200 several months after that.
That's unbelievable.
And I was there from 59 to 61.
It's so weird because it's one of those things where you become part of the myth of the building. I remember the woman who worked there told me you lived there, and I was very excited to know that.
You never knew the story about that?
No.
I mean, it's a lovely, lovely elevator building, 20 stories, I think.
Yeah.
But it was one of the few buildings in New York where the heating engineer, the conditioning engineer, designed a system whereby somehow or other the heat would be generated at the bottom and float up.
Okay.
Based on heat rising.
Okay.
Except that the upper floors, it somehow never got to the upper floors.
Yeah.
You would have icicles forming on the windows inside.
But it was a good idea.
Well, I'm sure it was not really good for him because I hear the designer committed suicide.
Oh, my God. That's funny, I have to say, in some mm-hmm. sad way. Mm-hmm. I lived on the fourth floor, so maybe it didn't get to me. It did affect me.
Well, you're lucky.
So where did you – I mean, I'd like to talk about a little bit about your history because I was telling these guys before you came on that I went through this period where I was really studying your technique. I mean, you're one of the great comedians. You're one of the great comic actors, and you do it with a sort of a cantankerous edge, and you never – too far away from yourself. Where did you get your chops? Where did you learn how to do that? Were you in Chicago? Is that where that started?
I think, as an individual, being an insecure individual, always tended to be the clown in high school, stuff
yeah.
like that. Never thought of myself. I mean, I couldn't impress him any other way, so I tried to make him laugh.
I can relate, yeah.
I didn't do Chevy Chase pratfalls
right.
because I didn't want to get hurt. But I never thought of myself as a comic, and when I started on the stage, I found that I could do it and do it well, but that I couldn't keep repeating it. I didn't know how to make that happen, so I feared it and stayed away from it until Mary Tyler Moore came on.
Really? Were you not part of the Second City in Chicago?
I was with the Legitimate Theater,
okay.
out of which Second City came. Before Second City, there was Compass.
Uh-huh.
And while Paul Sills, who created both, was busy hopping between the two of them, I wanted to make it on my own, and I was too bourgeois to think that I could make it in improv. It just didn't seem legit enough.
Oh, really?
I planned to go to New York and do it on my own, Ma.
Yeah.
And eventually, when Second City came to California, uh-huh. where I had eventually gone to, I worked out with them here, knowing all of them, worked out with them, and they came to regard me as an alumnus.
Oh, okay. That's where I got that information. Well, that's yeah. interesting. So now you were on one of the most memorable sitcoms. You were one of the most memorable characters in television. It's one of the greatest shows of all time. When I was a kid, my mom would watch it, and I would watch it, and everybody would watch it. So what do you think of sitcoms now? What do you think of the quality of television at this point in time?
Well, I'm too busy trying to keep up with the human comedy of my government.
Yes.
So I don't get a lot of time to watch primetime mm-hmm. TV.
Okay.
I tend to look for special shows on cable.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to make an effort to set them aside. So I'm not a regular watcher. Seinfeld was the last comedy I religiously watched.
And you liked it?
Oh, very much.
Okay, so now let's move into politics by way of transitioning this way. In the film JFK, you were you played not only a serious character, but a menacing, horrifying, and frightening character. You're definitely capable of that. I guess I got two questions around that. One is, was that the first time you ever worked with Jack Lemmon?
No, I worked with Jack Lemmon on Broadway in 1960 in a play called Face of a Hero.
He was a great actor, huh?
He was beautiful.
Good guy.
And not just a great actor. He was a beautiful human being.
Yeah. He's done some of the greatest work on screen I've ever seen. Now, all right, so in JFK.
I'll tell you a story.
Okay, great.
Costa Gavras wanted me for Missing. as the father. And I got shot down by other people at Universal, I guess it was. So I carried a big burning resentment for a long time against those people. And not against Jack.
Yeah.
I mean, you, the actor gets off his own, you do it.
Yeah.
And I won him an Oscar, as I recall. And then just the other night, I watched it. I allowed myself to watch it for the first time. And I had to look at it and say, they were smart to cast Jack in it.
Yeah. It's amazing how resentment gets, you know, it kind of gives away in the heart a little bit. And sometimes it can take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the JFK, I guess we can start there in terms of being part of that film. Was that a political motion by you? Did you want to be involved with it because it was something you believed politically?
You have to remember, I'm an actor.
Okay.
An actor, unless it involves matricide, infanticide, disemboweling on screen, eating feces, an actor will want to do the job. And I was very happy to do the job. Secondarily, I was in total awe of what Oliver Stone did there. I thought he was brilliant, brilliant. I'd fallen in love with him for what he did in Salvador, and this was a tremendous follow-up. So whether it's true or not, I don't believe the conspiracy as necessarily presented in the movie. I feel there was a conspiracy, though.
Yeah, okay. Now, let's start with that. In terms of your politics, you have been somebody who's been an activist for a long time. Where did that start, and what are some of the causes you were involved in?
Most of the time, I was an upward-coming actor, let's say.
Yeah.
I would certainly allow my liberal bent to be displayed, but never go too far.
Right.
At the same time, I felt I owed life for two things. The fact that I was a young Jew in Kansas City during Hitler, number one, and number two, that I was something of a liberal actor who wasn't big enough to be recognized to be blacklisted.
Right. Okay.
And knowing that, and I would keep saying to myself, when do I, and I would always contribute and attend the garden parties or whatever else, but I would never make that push.
Right.
And finally, with the arrival and celebrity of Lou Grant, I said, if not now, when?
Exactly. Hillel, that's interesting you bring that up. We're going to continue talking to Ed Asner. I almost said Lou Grant in just a second, so stay with us.
Now, please remain seated. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest in studio is actor, activist, independent, speculative investigator Ed Asner. We have begun a conversation about politics. On the break, Ed was telling me about a script he got about E. Howard Hunt by a fellow named Mark Lane, who wrote a book claiming that E. Howard Hunt was in cahoots with the CIA in the conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. And what happened to that script?
Well, they're hoping to do it. I'm not sure if it's going to be stage or film.
Interesting.
And they're going ahead with it. But I think the point is, I think the book sold 250,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
There was something of a blanket covered, thrown over it, so it didn't get a lot of publicity at the time,
mm-hmm.
primarily from the New York Times. And Where is all the question and answering that should be going on with this blatant statement of fact?
Yeah, it's a very good question. How the culture makes people who investigate things in an alternate way look to be wackos. Now,
mm-hmm.
this is just yesterday, the Pentagon released film footage of a plane hitting the Pentagon.
Tell me, what did the plane look like?
Yeah, I know, exactly. I mean, you can't see the plane. Now, my question is, you've been doing a lot of work around this right now,
yeah.
And you're affiliated with, or are you working with 9/11 Truth LA? Or?
I'm with them. I'm not doing any work.
Okay, but you support the premise. Now, I have always been one to say that either they were complicit through negligence, but sometimes I look at this stuff, Ed, and I watch the film, and I say that the planning that would be required to execute a strategy and a scheme as broad as some of these investigations claim for this administration or any other administration seems to be far-fetched. Am I wrong?
Yeah, everything's wrong. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the facts proposed and put forth by scientists,
yeah,
why can't somebody come forward and say, all right, we've had enough of this, and it needs the people to mass behind these ideas of the free fall of the buildings, the destruction of number 7.
Yeah.
All of the factors that went into... if nobody knows about the free fall, free fall occurs at something like 9.5, something like that. Those buildings fell at like 10 point something.
Right.
No building, no high rise has ever been demolished by a fire.
Right.
This fire not only demolished it in 10 point seconds, the central columns, the 47 central columns, should never have been demolished due to the heat from jet fuel, which supposedly is quoted at 650, and it takes at least 1,500 degrees to affect steel.
So let me ask you a question, just in terms of practical politics, not unlike the JFK assassination. Now, let's assume there was a cover-up there. Now, let's assume there is a massive cover-up here. And these questions, not unlike questions around the Kennedy assassination, become, you know, very difficult to answer, you know, even this close to the event happening. Isn't it also important to start to facilitate a change in administration and the way the government runs this country? I feel like a lot of times a lot of people who are progressive and want the truth, they get derailed by things that become unanswerable, and they get lost in a vortex of information that can't be proven, and we lose a great amount of political momentum.
They don't want to have their lives taken over by the enormity of what we talk about here.
Right.
And it would be taken over. I resist. I try to keep on living my life and merely talk about it and encourage whatever efforts to further this truth I can. But it's an enormity that also contains danger in it.
Yeah.
Danger of condemnation as a nutso in public.
Sure.
Danger, perhaps, by the way this government moves now, of repercussions and recriminations by the government against you. So it requires a lot of responsibility and a lot of... go for broke.
Guts, yeah. Now, let's just get into some particulars then, because I rewatched some of the 9/11 documentary. How do they explain the crew of that plane, the one that hit the Pentagon? Where, if it wasn't a plane, where are the people that were on that plane? Were they killed?
I'm not following your question.
I'm saying that if a plane did not go into the Pentagon, that flight that was supposed to have gone into the Pentagon, what happened to those people?
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about conspiracy, if you can create a conspiracy that destroys a building with over 2,000 people in it.
Yeah, why? Yeah, right. Why
there were, what, 60-some people on that plane?
Why wouldn't they just take them out as well?
Yeah,
exactly. So now, in terms of mobilizing people, I know there's a community in Hollywood that have become a little more vocal about this. You know, we've talked about it on this show. You know, I'm certainly, you know, open-minded because I believe that this administration is capable of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we start to make it a little more, like even today when the Pentagon releases this thing and you still can't see the plane, that makes people who believe what you believe even more angry and even more dead set on trying to do something about this. But how do you see that we facilitate some sort of cultural momentum to resolving this?
Well, seek out the 9/11 group in your community.
Right.
Find out or communicate by email or by mail or by phone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And get all the information and ingest yourself.
Yep. In terms of your life in politics and your life as a politically aware person, have you ever seen a more heinous administration than this one?
No. It's a nonpareil.
Yeah.
It's a pariah nonpareil.
Yeah. Even when Nixon was around, did you have...
Let's bring Nixon back.
That'd be difficult. We'd get a Ouija board and some holograms. I think with technology, you can do that, actually.
I mean, he was just a self-seeking politician. He wasn't a maniac.
Yeah, I have a tremendous amount of fear. Are you involved in terms of the anti-war movement at all? Are you doing other work around that as well?
Wherever I can. I don't think there's anything going on now other than trying to find the politician who will run for the presidency and demand the return of the troops immediately.
The truth. I think that if we can shift the balance in the House, maybe we can get John Conyers and some of those people to at least begin an investigation that could lead to some impeachment proceedings, although the Democrats are starting to pull away from saying that word now.
Well, look what they did to Russ Feingold and calling for censure.
I know. Unbelievable. And Feingold's the only guy, one of the few guys with real guts. But I think that it all depends on these midterm elections, and I hope to hell that those aren't rigged. I mean, because then you have the election box fraud as well.
You still have the perpetuation of Diebold and the other electronic voting machines.
Ed, do we have any hope? Has there got to be some hope? Any? No.
Is that why you brought me here?
I said, let's get Ed Asner in. He'll make light of the situation. We could have a few laughs.
Well, you know, we live in the greatest country in the world before it got betrayed.
Yeah.
We live in what people think is the most comfortable country in the world, but I begin to have my doubts about that. I think that's another blanket of misinformation about how people live in this country. We certainly have over 40 million who don't get taken care of medically. And compared to other countries, that's disgraceful.
Yes. And I think what you said, the quote from Rabbi Hillel, which it actually hangs on my bulletin board for some reason or another, that is one of those great cryptic equations of identity, that you know, if I am not for myself, then who will be for me? If I am only for myself, then who am I? If not now, when? I think in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of personal responsibility, in terms of people, you know, really weighing out what their comfort is worth and whether or not it is real comfort or else a profound state of denial and ignorance, even though they may be intelligent liberal people, you know, what is the cost of that to this country?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really, you know, what you're angry about and what everyone is angry about. At some point, you know, enough people have to say, look, you know, where is the truth here?
Well, that's the exact point. It is time to act by people when the lies begin to outweigh the truth. And I think the lies now outweigh the truth.
Why do you think people feel so powerless to do anything? Is it just out of fear of having an opinion, or they're too comfortable? You have peers in show business. You have peers that have money that don't make time to do this. What do you think stops them?
Well, you know, I hate to go back to ancient history, but when I spoke out on Central America,
mm-hmm.
and the show finally got canceled, I thought I was just speaking the truth. But when it got canceled and I became regarded as a commie, it wasn't just me. It was, and I shouldn't be doing this because it's an ad for not speaking out, because I found that I cost 200 people jobs who did the show. I found that my son got threatened because possibly being my son, so that Every you never think of it when you say I will take the consequences, except when you take the consequences, there are ripple effects to family and friends and fellow employees all around you, and that is an enormous intimidator.
The fear of reprisal and this was during Lou Grant.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly appreciate the work that you're doing now, and that you have the courage to speak out now. And I think it does mean something. And I think that, you know, what you're talking about on the other side of that reprisal situation is if people start talking to friends, start talking to people they work with, and start making people, it's like the old union days.
We have to make it fashionable not to go along right now.
Well, that's what this entire network is based on, and I hope we're achieving that. And I want to thank you for taking your time today to talk to us, Ed Asner. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a second with stuff.
now, Pink Tacos, Marc Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Oh, I read about that. It's a chain in Arizona. A restaurant chain is getting some flack.
I don't know why.
I don't know. You ever had a pink taco?
Excuse me? Come again?
All right, now for today's News Crunch, we're pulling in a new guy to the Marc Maron Show. He's no stranger to the political talk beat. He makes regular appearances on Countdown with Keith Olbermann, and he's the national editor for Rolling Stone magazine. Welcome to the show, Eric Bates.
Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, like today, it seems that the administration is buckling under the need for Congress to know what the hell they're doing, and they've agreed to congressional panels to get the NSA briefings. What's going on with that?
Well, they've agreed to very limited briefings for an obviously political reason. They want to get their nominee for the director of the CIA, Michael Hayden, through. And Michael Hayden is the one who, at the NSA, has been responsible for overseeing the secret eavesdropping that's been going on American citizens.
And those confirmation hearings begin tomorrow, right?
They begin tomorrow, and Hayden's really going to face some fierce questioning on his role in this program. And Bush, until this point, has absolutely stonewalled, refused to brief Congress on this, even though a 1947 law requires the administration to brief the full House and Senate intelligence committees on this kind of activity.
Now, let me ask you something, Eric. Now, there's been some revelations around this. That, you know, some of these phone companies are saying they weren't in cahoots with the administration. I heard that there was something signed by Negroponte at the behest of Bush that would make it okay for him to utilize the phone companies like that. Have they already covered their asses on this before these hearings even begin?
I don't think so. I think there's a lot more still to come out. If you read the phone companies' denials, they're very carefully worded to basically say they weren't under contract to provide the information. So how they provided the information and what they provided still isn't clear, but it seems pretty clear at this point that the administration is involved in trying to compile a database of phone records that they can use to in intelligence gathering.
Now, this is interesting too. Out today, we have that a lawsuit against the AT&T, the telephone company, that a federal judge says that they will seal the records of AT&T, you know, being involved with the administration on this, and that this could be the first lawsuit challenging the administration's the surveillance program there. Have you heard about that?
Yes, that's right.
How does that lay out? What is that?
It's unclear whether the courts are going to go along with it. I mean, the problem with this kind of issue is there is a real need to balance national security and privacy issues, and how you do that, you have to be very careful in how you do that. The problem with what the administration has done all along is that they've tipped the balance so that there's no oversight. Basically, the Bush administration's position has been, we get to do whatever we say we get to do. The whole point of oversight is to make sure that the judicial and legislative branches get to double-check what the president wants to do. And what got very little attention is that the Justice Department was trying to investigate, the Ethics Office at the Justice Department wanted to investigate its own lawyers who advised the administration on this to see if they had advised the administration properly. Last week, the Ethics Office announced that it was going to drop its investigation. Why? Because the Bush administration wouldn't give the lawyers who were doing the investigation the security clearance needed to look into the matter. So any attempt to look into who's done what on this issue has been completely stonewalled by the president.
So this is standard practice for this administration, though, to overreach the point where it's unconstitutional, and then to seal it up, and then to challenge the judicial system and the people of this country and the representatives of those people that care to kind of move backwards from this extreme position they've taken, which is ultimately unconstitutional.
That's right, and they're going even further now. Attorney General Gonzalez has hinted last month in testimony to the House Judiciary Committee that he thinks the president may even have the power to order wiretaps on domestic phone calls without court approval. So far, they've only been doing it on international phone calls, but they're now saying that they believe they may have the power to do it on domestic phone calls as well.
Now, isn't ultimately the fear in the long term here, Eric Bates from Rolling Stone magazine, isn't the fear that, whatever is whatever precedents are set now in the name of national security can be manipulated in the future and continue to deny people rights, whether it's terrorism, whether it's pornography, whether it's religious belief, whether it's all those other things within the Constitution that we are guaranteed the freedom to have here, that who the hell knows in two administrations from now if being a Jew or a liberal is not going to be considered criminal.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the test in these cases, and the test that the Republicans and the right-wingers who support what the president's doing ought to ask themselves, is not how do you feel about President Bush doing this. The test is how do you feel about someone who you distrust or you despise doing this. I'd be interested to know if a lot of the right-wingers who support this, how they would feel about Hillary Clinton having this power, or Al Gore having this power, or John Kerry having this power. I think you'd be hearing a very different story from them if that was the case. This has to stand the test not just of whether you like the person who's doing it now, but whether in the worst-case scenario with someone who you distrust or disagree with violently, if you would be willing to give them that power.
Well, it's interesting, you know, in terms of ideological behavior on behalf of Democrats and the principles therein, that they would be less likely to be this secretive and heinous. Am I wrong? I'm asking you to be partisan, and I apologize.
Yeah, I think that any president after 9/11 would be faced with some very difficult decisions about how to gather the kind of intelligence that really is needed to protect the country. That's a real interest that we would want any president to take. In fact, there are serious questions about whether the administration is doing enough and doing the right things to protect the country. What's really unfortunate here is that a lot of what the administration is doing is completely unnecessary. The president's move and assertion that he's allowed to eavesdrop on Americans making international phone calls without court warrants, there's no reason to do that. The courts that he has to go to that were set up by Congress to receive permission to do that kind of wiretapping, first off, there are emergency provisions that would allow the president to intercept international calls and get permission afterwards.
The FISA courts, right.
The FISA courts. He can already do that. Secondly, the FISA court almost never turns down a request. Since 1995, there have been more than 10,000 applications to wiretap calls, and FISA has approved all but four of them out of 10,000.
Yeah, this was just a control power thing. This was an intimidation thing. Eric Bates, I really appreciate you dropping by here.
Thanks.
You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. That was Eric Bates from Rolling Stone magazine. Yeah, it's not about security. It's about intimidation of everybody and a denial of rights. We will be back. I think Lawton Smalls is on the phone. Am I right?
And now, what's that running down? Your leg? Mark Maron.
Yeah, that was a good one. What the hell is wrong with you? Huh?
You know, I just have a huge bowl of these things, and I randomly pick them out and bring them out here for your joy.
So look, you know, I don't know, man. I don't know. I got to do this. I went to yoga last night. So this is all moving. I looked into anger management, by the way.
Oh, how's that come about? I was anxious about that.
I thought it was something like they had franchises, like Curves Gym or something, I thought that, you know, they had little anger management places, like a chain of them. But it's not. It's fairly specific. There's a couple of companies that do it. It doesn't seem like there's a set program. Some company called Anderson, but it seems like workplace related. But I'm not going to let it deter me. I'm going to look into it. I was able to manage my anger last night. I'm telling you, yoga makes me angry. I don't know why, but, you know, because I'm not going to it for the right reasons. I'm not looking for some sort of spiritual connection. Basically, the idea of yoga is you go through these series of positions that you hold for an inordinate amount of time till your muscles and joints start humming with strain, and then you stop for a few minutes, and that humming mm-hmm. is supposed to be the equivalent of some sort of spiritual peace. It's a trick. It's an endorphin rush. But I'll tell you one thing. It does help you physically in terms of maintaining your posture and helping you age properly.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is all the jargon, all the little talking that the teacher does during it and the process of it, I get irritable. I get frustrated. I am not in yoga mind. I am not yogi-minded.
You know why that is.
Why?
It's a chick thing.
No, it's not.
It's just for chicks.
What, are you kidding me?
They get dressed up in the, you know, tight Spanx things, and some guy at the front of the class goes, do this, do that, and blah, 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 you know, gyration. You know, ride your bike, you know, take a boxing course. Yeah. Boxing.
I've taken boxing. It's okay. I don't get the joy out of it. See, you're making me realize that I do get something out of yoga. But here's what I'm telling you, is that it does make you open up, and it makes you it's not vulnerable, but you're raw. After an hour and a half holding positions and sweating, you're raw. So I get out of it and I'm like, what the hell, man? I'm cranky. This is crap. And I almost went home and got mad for no reason. I'm like, whoa. Dude,
I thought it was helping you out for a while.
It is. It's helping me to burn off a lot of steam. But right after yoga, very aggravated. Let's do this. I don't want to leave him on hold too long. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that our listeners know what's going on in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So here now is our very own Planet Bush bureau chief, Lawton Smalls. Hello, Lawton.
Hello, Mark. You can't spell Jesus without U.S. You remember that.
Oh, that's genius.
US.
Yes, I'll remember that. Look, buddy, look. The NSA has been listening in on millions of private phone calls. I mean, come on. This is the lowest blow yet, Lawton. The lowest.
What's the matter, Mark? Worried? Got things to hide? Dirty little secret?
No, I don't.
Well, that's good, because the NSA is monitoring this phone call right now.
What?
Well, yeah, when I heard about President George W. two-terms mandate Bush's surveillance program, I called up the NSA and I said, hey, please track all of my phone calls. That's what a patriot does, mister. Hello out there, NSA man. Can y'all hear us okay? Should we speak up a little louder for you? I just want to say to you, NSA boys, you're doing a heck of a job. Jeb Bush in 08.
All right, okay then, Lawton. I want them to hear this. This program is the worst violation of privacy and civil liberties ever. Ever! Was that loud enough?
You don't get it, do you, Mark?
What?
We're at war. W-A-R. We need every tool at our disposal to fight these evil terrorist evildoers. You know, if you weren't so whacked out of your mind on ecstasy with an orange pacifier hanging out of your mouth, well, you know, the disco's closed, liberals. It's morning. Time to face the daylight.
Hey, how does violating the privacy, of ordinary Americans keep us safe from terrorists? Huh, Lawton? Tell me that.
Oh, boo-hoo-hoo. Protect us from the bad men, Daddy, just as long as it doesn't interfere with my baby-killing meth orgy. Well, maybe you should call up Susan Sarandon. Maybe she'll keep you safe from the terrorists, huh?
Hey, look, Lawton, how can you justify monitoring tens of millions of calls from ordinary citizens? That's just crazy. You think that many Americans are affiliated with Al-Qaeda?
No, Mark. Twice that many.
Oh, come on.
Did you know one out of every three Americans works directly for Al-Qaeda? That's true. Every day there are tens of millions of calls discussing Al-Qaeda business. I could show you the phone lines.
Uh-huh.
They're right here.
Uh-huh.
Al-Qaeda's written right there on their paycheck stubs.
Yeah.
Take a look at your paycheck, mister. I'm sure it's written on there somewhere in Arabic, paid to the order of Markama bin Marin.
Oh, stop it. Stop it. Would you stop it, Lawton? So you're telling me that you're okay having agents listening in on your conversations? Is that what you're telling me?
Of course. My conscience is as clear as Ozark spring water. Yours, on the other hand.
What about me?
Well, my friends at the NSA have supplied me with a tape of you on the telephone just last week. Put it this way, you might want to get a lawyer.
My conscience is clear, too. Now, you go ahead and play it. Play your stupid tape. I dare you.
Whew. Okay. I warned you, though.
Have you been a bad Democrat?
Yes, ma'am. I've been a very bad Democrat. I should be punished.
Are you wearing your bad Democrat underpants?
Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes, Mrs. Clinton.
That's better. Now say the pledge. Say it!
I love Al-Qaeda. I love Ted Kennedy. I hate George W. two-terms mandate Bush. Do I get pudding now? Please? Bad boy wants pudding. Pudding!
Whoa.
Wrong tape! Wrong tape!
Yeah.
Wrong!
Yeah. yeah, it's wrong for the government to spy on our private business, isn't it, Lawton?
Yeah, so wrong! So wrong! You're not gonna tell any anybody about this, are you, Mark?
I don't know, Lawton. I mean, you were threatening me a minute ago.
Please!
All right. Okay, all right. Hey, NSA guy listening in, do you have any tapes of me?
Not yet, Mark.
That's what I thought. All right, Lawton. Right, pull it together, buddy. Just pull it together, will you?
What about Mishnah, Mark? I'm pretty sure she's in Al-Qaeda. Uh-uh. Have you checked?
No, all right, Lawton. Goodbye. Goodbye, NSA guy.
Bye, Mark. Hey, God loves you. Deal with it. Hey, NSA guy, I need to talk to you about that tape for a minute.
Yeah, I bet you that they need to talk about that tape. I always think I know Lawton. I know what's going on, and then you go to the next level with that guy, and it's even darker and more creepy than you would ever imagine.
I just think he needs to see somebody about his throat.
Yeah, everybody has some dark secrets. I mean, I'm not judging his relationship with his dominatrix. You know, if that's your bag, you're entitled to it. Do you understand?
I don't know. I am. I think it's kind of disturbing.
Do you know anybody that is into that?
Dominatrix?
Yeah.
I think we all have a dominatrix of sort.
My buddy used to date one, and it's quite a weird thing when they get called from, you know, while they're at dinner because she has to go pee on a rich guy. See you later, honey. I'll be here when you get home. I'll rent a movie. All right, we'll be back with Michelle Goldberg and her book Kingdom Coming: The Rise of Christian Nationalism.
Sounds great.
Okay, thanks.
All right, you bet.
And now he's got the scars to prove it, Mark Maron.
Jim, I think we're going to answer some questions here for you. All right, I got an email here from Glenn in Astoria, busting me a new one
Glenn.
For getting on you. He says, Mark, you really missed the boat marginalizing Jim's plans to buy a diesel engine and convert it. By trivializing and ridiculing him, you missed an opportunity to explore something that might be of great interest to your listeners. It seems to me that if one can take the issue from the hippie margins and make it accessible to your hopefully growing audience, many people can benefit. You're always talking about how we convince ourselves we're doing something merely by listening to liberal talk radio and not actually taking action. Well, Jim's talking about taking action in a truly accessible way. If he does this, I think there should be a continuing updates as to how it's working out for him. If it works well, it isn't, and it isn't too much trouble for him, it'll encourage others to do the same. If it's a disaster, well, it'll probably be hilarious. Either way, it's great radio.
It's interesting. He says taking this subject from the hippie margins or whatever, and bringing it to the forefront. The diesel engines were, if Motown Girl is correct, diesel engines were originally intended to run on biofuel.
Well, we're going to talk to Congressman Ron Kind here in just a second. He is serving in his fifth term representing the 3rd District of Wisconsin, a rural area in the western part of the state with more real estate bordering the Mississippi River than any other district, and until recently more cows than people, apparently. Kind sits on the budget, resources, and education, and on the budget, resources, and education, and the workforce committees, and since elected to Congress, has focused his attention on fiscal responsibility, education, agriculture, health care, and, Jim, environmental conservation. Welcome to the show, Congressman.
Hey, Mark. Glad to be with you.
Well, you know, we have this, I'm glad you're here because, you know, Jim and I have this, it's not really a debate, but, you know, as the emailer just said, can we make, I know you've got a plan, can we make biofuel accessible and can it become available to enough people to make it practical for the country? What do you think?
I think not only can we, but we should. We have to start reducing our dependence on imports from foreign oil, especially from the Middle East. There's so much potential with the new technology that's coming online that we can literally be investing in the Midwest as opposed to the Mideast with all the petrol dollars that are flowing over there, propping up these regimes, helping terrorist networks find their financing in that. And there are a lot of examples of this being done. I mean, we've got the flex fuel technology right now where it costs about $30 per vehicle to put flex fuel into these new cars.
What's
coming
flex
online.
Fuel? Oh, that's the mixture?
That enables the cars to be able to accept biofuels as a fuel source. And not only that, but increased energy output, too. I mean, they've refined the technology now, and one of the raps with biofuels has been there is a drop-off in power, and that's true. But as opposed to it being a 25 to 30% drop, we're only talking about a 15 to 16% drop with the latest technology with biofuels.
Yeah, well, what do you got there, Jim?
Now, by biofuels, you're not only talking about ethanol, but
cellulosic biofuels and
corn oil as well for diesel engines.
Switchgrass, too. I think we could be ramping up between the next 2 to 5 years and doing some major switchgrass biofuels. So there won't have to be so many acres going into corn or soybean for the ethanol production.
So now, on top of some of that other stuff you're doing up there, this is good for farmers up in your state, huh?
Well, it can be, and this could be the great investment rural America has been looking for. It could spur whole new industries and job creation. That money would stay in rural America, and it could lead to many other spinoffs. But on top of it all, this is something that really excites the younger generation, giving them some hope and some opportunity that they could be the next generation that's not dependent on foreign oil. Where the previous generations often referred to as the greatest generation, I believe the next generation has to be known as the greenest generation. And this is one of the ways they can do that.
I'm happy to hear that, Congressman Ron Fine from Wisconsin. I'm also excited that the Democrats are starting to really pick up the ball with this environmental issue. It seems that it's really got some teeth now to every American, and it's very clear to every American that there is a danger of global warming, that there is a danger of this consumer culture we created of depleting everything, and it seems like it's really taken off, and I'm glad you guys are picking up on it.
Well, it really is, and we've just released a new energy policy, too, this last week. The Rural Working Group that I'm a member of released a new energy policy that talks about this investment with the farmers of our country, and there's so many win-win-wins by doing this. It's something we should have been doing, you know, 30 years ago when President Carter was calling for this, because we knew where the trend lines were going, and it's shame on us if we don't seize the opportunity with $3 at the pump to start pivoting off our dependence on fossil fuels generally, which is the major contributor to global warming today.
So let's talk a little bit about this $70 billion tax cut that our president, carelessly put into play today. Who does that hurt?
Well, I tell you, it leads to the historically large budget deficits that we've seen return under the Bush administration. We're going to be debating a budget resolution on the floor this evening, and they're calling for the fifth debt ceiling increase in the last 6 years.
Unbelievable.
This has been the largest and quickest expansion of national debt in our nation's history under this administration. And they have no plan on how to turn it around.
I don't think they care, Congressman Kine. I just don't. I think that this is a hit and run for them. I think that they have made themselves and their friends rich, and they just don't care about the future of the country.
I think you're right, and I think they don't think there's political consequences to this borrow and spend mentality that they've been pursuing these last 6 years. But what's dangerous about it is that it's usually those least able to afford the cuts that are proposed in budget deficit times that have to bear the brunt. I mean, they just had a $12 billion raid on student aid in their budget reconciliation, and they point to the budget deficit as the reason they have to do it. But what's different today, and most people don't realize this, but China is the number one purchaser of our government debt, and I don't believe it's in our best long-term economic interest or any other interest to be so dependent on China to be financing our deficits the way they are today.
So you're saying that most Americans are unwittingly outsourced Chinese workers?
I think so, yeah, because right now China doesn't have to have a big military buildup and invade us. They're going to own us at this current rate with the fiscal policies pursued by the Bush administration and his cohorts here in Congress.
Well, let me tell you, I am completely confident that the Democrats are going to win the House back here in November. And if that happens, as I think it will, what's the first line of business you guys are going to do?
Well, I think we're going to reinstitute pay-as-you-go rules. They worked well in the 1990s. They gave us 4 years of budget surpluses where we were actually paying down the national debt and preparing for the aging population of this country.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing we're going to do, we're going to move forward on a new energy policy for a new century. We're also going to implement an innovation and creativity agenda that's going to invest in Americans so they can compete in the global marketplace and so we can remain the most innovative and creative nation in the world.
Do you think we can investigate the administration a little bit and a little more efficiently in terms of...
I think there may be a couple of subpoenas heading over to the White House demanding answers to a lot of questions that people have in this country today. It's something that they have not been held accountable for. And I think, at the very least, we need to restore some checks and balances in our government again.
Great. And you buddies with Russ Feingold?
Russ is a good friend. He's a good man. He's he calls it the way he sees it.
He's one of the few good men. Well, you say hi to him for Mark Maron and Jim Earle over here on the Mark Maron show.
Sure will.
And thanks a lot for talking to us, Congressman Kind.
My pleasure, guys. Have fun.
You take care. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
That was Congressman Ron Kind from the 3rd District up there in Wisconsin with some a little bit of vision there for the Democrats in the future. He was talking a good game on the environment.
Very reasonable man.
Yeah, you like that, huh, Jim?
Yeah, I like that kind of thing. It's about time, huh? Right? What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it. And I was just being devil's advocate. Glenn knew that, the guy who wrote us the email.
Yeah.
He said, just for case in point, he also told a story about a buddy of his. Who had a truck. Maybe we'll spread it out over a few days because I think that we're going to be talking about this more. All right, hang out, people. We got the rest of it in a minute.
And now it's time again to update your PayPal account. Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. How's it going with that My Friend thing? Did you get a couple friends yet?
Yeah, I got... Yeah, boy, it was kind of creepy. Somebody just wanted to be my friend.
Out of nowhere?
Because
you linked to me, right? Because I accepted you as a friend.
Well, even before that, some guy out of the blue just...
Sure, man. Sure. And now that people know that we just brought it up, they're going to go look for you. By tomorrow, you're going to have more friends than you even know what to deal with, and you're not even going to know what to do with them. People, I've been talking about the pending possible overthrow of this country from the inside by the Christo-fascist zombie brigade for a couple of years now. Some people only hear me as being anti-Christian, but I am anti-Christo-fascist theocrat, people. Michelle Goldberg has written a book that should wake everyone up to the real threat of an anti-American movement in this country, who are a lot closer than anyone thinks to accomplishing their ends. The book is Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism in America. The author, Michelle Goldberg, is with us on the phone from New York. How are you, Michelle?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. So how much time do we have before we all have to wear a cross on our armbands?
I actually think we've got some time.
Okay.
I think that there would have to be really great catastrophes and a real crisis of legitimacy before, you know, you have some kind of situation like Gideon in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. But that doesn't mean that the situation as it is right now is acceptable.
Now, let me just see. I have been talking about this movement for a long time in terms of my fear of it. And I constantly get criticized by mainstream Christians who believe I am being anti-Christian by differentiating between evangelical Christianity with this nationalism intent and regular Christianity. There is definitely a difference.
Well, right, and there's actually, that's why I call it Christian nationalism, and there's a difference between Christian nationalism and even some forms of very conservative evangelical Christianity.
What is the difference?
Well, Christian nationalism is a political ideology that seeks to subsume American government to biblical authority, that seeks to recreate our great secular republic as some kind of Christian nation.
Now, you say that the roots of this, it's interesting to me that the roots both of the conservative hijacking of culture and this Christian nationalism movement come out of Barry Goldwater's people.
Right, although Barry Goldwater would be, or is, you know, had been completely appalled by the growing power of the religious right. And on social issues, Barry Goldwater was something of a libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
But that's right. It was three people who all worked on the Barry Goldwater campaign, Richard Viguerie, Paul Weyrich, and Howard Phillips, who, you know, in a very kind of calculated move, decided that there was an opportunity to pry socially conservative, blue-collar people away from the Democrats. And they went out and they recruited a somewhat obscure Baptist preacher named Jerry Falwell to start the Moral Majority.
Now, that what has happened now, it's interesting because, you know, the Powell Manifesto and the creation of the Heritage Foundation and all those conservative think tanks, which really have, you know, they've both, the Christian nationalism movement and the conservative think tank movement, have really sort of matured over 30 years of grassroots organizing. And I guess, what was it, in the 80s, with Operation Rescue being appropriated by some of the Republicans, that's how they really have taken over now, isn't it?
Well, Operation Rescue and the whole anti-abortion movement was really, really important in uniting newly politicized evangelical Protestants with Catholics, because it used to be that when evangelical Protestants, when kind of right-wing Protestant nativist movements spent a lot of their energy fighting Catholics. Now that the two groups have been united in this Christian nationalist movement, they've been able to really form a united front against other Americans of other religions or of no religion.
So let's talk. I guess we should talk a little bit about the beginning, get a little history around this about Christian nationalism. So a lot of the people that have had, that are big motivators in this have been around for a long time. Like you mentioned, Falwell, LaHaye, Pat Robertson. Now, where did this ideology come from? Is it, can you talk a little bit about like John Rush Dooney and Dominionism?
Sure. It's a hybrid of many things. I mean, Tim LaHaye, for example, got his start in the John Birch Society. Mm-hmm. He was a major Birch organizer in California, who, and his ideology today is just a kind of Christian fundamentalist version of the paranoid conspiracy theories of the John Birch Society.
Okay.
But in a broader sense, what Christian nationalism, it came about when there is a very small sect called Christian Reconstructionism, which is the most openly theocratic wing of American of Protestantism. They really do call for the imposition of a full-blown theocracy, you know, the execution of homosexuals, execution of women who are unchaste before marriage, disenfranchisement of unbelievers. And traditionally, most evangelicals who are what's called premillennial dispensationalists, who believe that the rapture is imminent and that only after the rapture will Jesus return and there will be 1,000 years of peace on earth, under Jesus' reign, that used to breed a kind of passivity. Because mm-hmm. if you believe that, you know, the world is hurtling towards apocalypse, mm-hmm. then you can kind of sit back and watch it happen. And so what happened in the 80s is there was a real effort on the part of some Reconstructionists to reach out and form alliances with a new generation of premillennial dispensationalist leaders, and they formed a number of organizations intended to kind of put these, you know, eschatological discussions aside and kind of politicize the vast majority of evangelical believers.
So that is to, in essence, to reach out to regular born-again Christians or evangelical movement people, I don't know if you can call them clergy, but people who have flocks,
mm-hmm.
to basically bulk up their numbers. And I assume that many members of these just born-again Christian flocks and these mega churches that have taken a lot of Christ out of their sermons are the unwitting foot soldiers of this nationalism.
Well, I'm not sure how unwitting you can be these days if you're going to some of these mega churches. I mean, I've been to some of them where the entire sermon from start to finish is about this kind of very, you know, the language is incredibly militaristic. Rod Parsley in outside of Columbus likes to say, you know, man your battle stations, lock and load. And, you know, all of the language is really about, you know, kind of defeating the homosexuals and the degenerates and uh-huh. But I would say that this, I mean, and I should say this isn't a conspiracy. I mean, this is just how political movements work.
People
get together, they decide to join forces, you know, they write manifestos and sign their names to it.
Right.
And there definitely was a conscious decision on the part of leaders like Tim LaHaye, you know, and others who signed, you know, a number of manifestos about, you know, to join forces to Christianize, or in their view, to re-Christianize America.
Well, let's talk about some of that, because this, over the last 30 years, these people have infiltrated governments on local levels, on state levels. They now have their own school where you have kids from,
Patrick Henry.
The Patrick Henry School, who are interning and working at the White House within the executive wing, being sort of designed to take the helm. I mean, is there any turning back from this? I mean, because it seems to me that these people with a vision and with the community momentum that they have in achieving their goal, that secularism and the selfishness that can come from that really needs to focus itself on taking some of these seats back.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I should say that what they're doing, I mean, the way they're working is legitimate in many ways. They have every right to organize and start their own schools and form their own parallel organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But what they've done, I mean, it really starts with the Christian Coalition. The Christian Coalition, which came out of the kind of organizational infrastructure of Pat Robertson's presidential campaign, really started organizing Christians to take over the Republican Party at the precinct level, at the school board level, to run for city council. And so, you know, little by little, the Republican Party became the party of the Christian right. They became inseparable. And what you've seen under Bush, you know, in the last 20 years, all of these parallel institutions have risen up. There's, you know, while there's the mainstream American Bar Association, you know, conservatives have the Federalist Society.
Right.
There's, you know, the American Medical Association. Conservatives have the Medical Institute for Sexual Health, which publishes this kind of, you know, which basically publishes research intended to buttress the idea of abstinence education and to discredit condoms and to discredit sex education.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you've seen is people from this kind of parallel culture, this parallel infrastructure, being infiltrated into the government, so that you have people associated with the Medical Institute for Sexual Health, you know, all over the Department of Health and Human Services,
right.
The Department, you know, doing population policy for USAID, you know, people who basically have kind of rejected all the tenets of mainstream science.
Yeah, which is
crazy. And now our, you know, national policy is being made kind of according to their theology.
It's just crazy. And I guess I'm actually hopeful in hearing the way you put that, because that means with the new administration, if we can, you know, successfully purge the country of whatever's going on here in terms of ideology and restriction of rights, that perhaps some of these people can be pushed out if the democratic structure works as it's supposed to work. Now, let me ask you this. I believe we only got a couple minutes left, and I believe that in my heart that these guys that we have in office now, George Bush, as born again as he may be, he was still using this particular movement to keep in power. Mm-hmm. My fear is that I think Sam Brownback is going to be their first real candidate for president.
Well, Sam Brownback is definitely a true believer. I mean, I'm agnostic about whether about the kind of balance of zealousness and cynicism in mm-hmm. George Bush. And, you know, I don't think Sam Brownback is going to be president. It would really take a kind of huge breakdown, some kind of huge collapse of, you know, the American system before...
I think they're planning that.
Well, they talk explicitly about, you know, they talk in terms of Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to build the vessel for when the flood comes so we can take the reins of power. You know, so this is not an imminent situation, but it's also, a kind of frightening prospect. And, yeah, absolutely, Sam Brownback is a no-holds-barred theocrat. And under him, you know, Christian nationalism would become, you know, more than just an influential social movement. It would become, you know, the kind of American way.
Well, it seems that there is a secret society within the higher echelons of government, Sam Brownback being a member of them, that meet and they talk about. They're literally congressional cells almost that function in secret to discuss these visions.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And again, I mean, it's not quite as occult as it sounds. You know, a lot of social movements have
right.
their kind of power centers within the federal government. But it's absolutely true that they have meetings and they have, and they've kind of signed on in many ways to a philosophy of government that is, you know, pretty much at odds with everything that the founders intended, and they are, you know, certainly working towards enacting it.
Wow. Well, I tell you, it's a beautifully researched book. I'm excited that someone has written it, and I hope that a lot of people read it, Michelle, because I think it just terrifies me more than anything else that mm-hmm. You know, that our Constitution will be hijacked by the Bible because of a theocratic movement in this country, and it can't turn out well. But the book is Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. Our guest has been Michelle Goldberg. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for
this week's disturbing environmental news that'll frighten you, but not enough to really do anything about it. Brought to you by
the good people at Monsanto, the leading producer of agricultural and chemical-related products. Hi, I'm Mark Maron, and I'm an alcoholic. Oops, wrong commercial. Hi, Mark Maron here from Monsanto. Founded over 100 years ago in a patriotic quest to fill America's need for saccharin, Monsanto continues its tradition of bettering the lives of millions of fortunate consumers through weird chemicals. From New York to Singapore, millions of Americans use countless gallons of Monsanto's Roundup in a never-ending battle against the ungodly menace of weeds. It's just another tribute to our belief that retarded children are a small price to pay for a tidy golf course. Did you know Monsanto is also the world's biggest producer of bioengineered crops? Bioengineered. Yeah, it's a big word. Basically, it means screwing with the building blocks of life to make a plant with its own insecticide. Now a farmer can grow corn that kills caterpillars, and probably lots of other things too, like babies. And that's why you should never let a baby play in a cornfield. And now back to this week's disturbing environmental news. Did I tell you I was an alcoholic?
This week, more than 100 oil-coated penguins turned up dead off the coast of Argentina. In Massachusetts, over 1,300 children living near a dye plant thought they were playing in pond water. They were actually swimming in mercury, chromium, and lead. Hello, cancer! And, as expected, today another 200,000 acres of rainforest were obliterated to help stuff your fat and obtuse faces with hamburgers and steaks. Eat well, barbarians! And that was this week's disturbing environmental news that'll frighten you, but not enough to really do anything about it. Brought to you by...
Hi, I'm Mark Maron, and I'm an alcoholic. What? Thank you, Jim. Thank you for that information.
You got to get that script straight.
I know, but I'm just used to saying it. You know what I'm saying?
I know how it is. I'm sorry.
Some guy sent us this guy. Who the hell sent this? This guy named Mike. One of our listeners sent an email with an article about a car that runs on compressed air. How do you like that?
Mike.
No, it's a pneumatic hybrid electric vehicle. The air is compressed using a small motor powered by a 48-volt battery, which powers both the air compressor and the electric motor. Once compressed, the air is stored in a tank, and the compressed air is used to pump those pistons. How do you like that?
How long does
Take a look at this. Oh, look at Mr. Critical. How long does it last, though?
Someone's married
to the grease car. You go ahead and take
grease
that.
Grease car. Hey, I'm married to the steam car before that.
I know, steam, grease, but all of a sudden I throw just air out, and you're like, wait, that can't. No, how
well,
that
you
can't
know,
work.
It takes a lot of energy to compress air.
Oh, look at Mr. Skeptical now.
You know?
Does it take a lot of energy to compress air?
And it takes a lot of storage space.
Oh, let me try. Like, you're right. I'm exhausted.
We're not. Okay. See, people can't see that. All they can do is hear you do that, and it sounds completely different from what you're intending.
All right. Well, look, folks, we don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed or, you know, whatever. So here, a lot happened in the news. Short order news now. Yeah. The U.S. government has released the video showing the hijacked airliner that slammed into the Pentagon on September 11th. The new video, the front of the hijacked Boeing 757, can be seen entering one video frame while Donald Rumsfeld waves a signal flag from a Pentagon window. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has been out of California almost 163 days since his inauguration in November 2003. That's nearly one of every 5 days he's been in office. Californians say that's one more slap in the face. Female interns say that's one less slap on the ass. Cuban President Fidel Castro furiously denied a story in Forbes magazine saying he was worth $900 million and said he would step down if the magazine could prove it. When asked where he would step down, Castro said somewhere in Switzerland. In Switzerland. That's the short order news for today, my friends. It's Wednesday. Tomorrow is Thursday, right? Then Friday, yeah. We're having a secret, what's the deal there? The lost episode.
It's a lost episode.
An episode that was only heard by five or six podcasters, but it was completely denied the general public. How do you like that? Hey, talk for a minute, buddy.
Sure. You know, this episode is
excellent. That was great. You really covered well. The episode...
Thanks. I did my best.
That was awesome. It's great that you got my back on that one. I just... thank God I found the paper here. We've got tomorrow on the show, David Sirota, who I love. Smart guy. real Democratic strategist, got guts, got brains, used to be over at the Center for American Progress. Now you can get his stuff on Sirota blog. He'll be in studio. Craig Ferguson, host of, what is it, The Late Show? Is
Late
that what it's
Show.
Called? Yeah, he's got a novel out that he's pitching, that he's selling. He's out there slogging this novel. He ran into a little trouble over here at the book fair, the book festival.
Why? What happened?
He was on a panel with a Susie Bright, a proactive lesbian, and another guy, this guy Cooper, who is a gay writer, and apparently there's a little trouble. I'm going to talk to him about it. He doesn't know I'm going to talk to him about it. Scott Carter, producer of Real Time with Bill Maher, will be here. Known him a long time. And Jim Short, Australian, vis-a-vis San Francisco, is going to be in the studio tomorrow.
Really? Jim Short?
Comedian. Yeah, he's in town.
I remember him, yeah.
He's doing the Late Late Show tonight. Or it'll be on. Yeah, it'll still be tonight by the time you hear this. And he'll be on the show tomorrow. So how about coming by for that? Good night, sheeple.